yourself a song to sing, and sing it till you're done. Yes, sing it hard and sing it well. Send the robber barons straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they've found. Whose crimes have gone unpunished now. Walk the streets a screaming now.
Greetings, all you 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus, Alternative Visions. Today we're going to talk about the status of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, in other words, NAFTA, free trade on steroids, that we've been calling it for over a year now. Anyway, before we start on that topic, though, I just want to tell listeners that the Alternative Vision show, as you may have heard on the announcements on the network, is moving to a new date and new time format. Starting this Saturday, March 1st, write it down, March 1st, this Saturday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time is when we will start our new format, well, not format, but new time slot. New time slot, new day. Again, Saturdays, 1 p.m. And this Saturday, I'm going to go solo again and talk more on this theme of what's happening to the global economy, or as I say, this emerging perfect storm. You know, perfect storms occur when you have three fronts, weather fronts, converging, and they amplify each other. And they intensify each other. That's how you get Hurricane Sandy's, remember? Okay. And what we got economically in the globe here is a perfect storm just beginning. And the three storm fronts are China slowing down, and at the same time, China having problems increasingly with shadow banks and speculators in their local housing and construction markets, and China's trying to get a handle on that. So China is the first front. The second front is the slow grinding drift towards deflation in the Eurozone. You know, a lot of hullabaloo about the Eurozone, that's continental Europe, 17 countries, having recovered from their second double dip. Well, barely recovery. We're talking about tenths of percents of GDP, hardly recovery, more like stagnation, and more indication of a drift towards actual price declines. They're almost at zero in terms of inflation, and that's a big problem and a harbinger of more negative conditions to come. Okay, so the Eurozone and deflation drift is the second front. The third front, and most active right now, is what we call emerging markets. You know, countries like Brazil, Indonesia, Turkey, India, etc. And they are in deep doo-doo as money, capital flight, is flowing out of those countries and collapsing those currencies. These three fronts are coming together. They're coming together and exacerbating each other. It's just beginning. It won't be linear and you know, inevitable in one direction. There'll be, you know, retreats and short recovery, so forth. But that's the long-term drift. Okay, that's what I talked about last week. This Saturday on the new show, 1 o'clock Eastern Time, we're going to go deeper into what's happening in China. And then in subsequent weeks, we will go deeper into other areas of the global economy, because the crisis is a global crisis, always has been. You cannot predict what's happening and where it's going by just looking at the U.S. You know, the crisis began in the U.S., first phase. It then shifted to Europe in 2010 to 12. Second phase, now it's shifting to the emerging markets. Third phase, crisis isn't over, it's just morphing and moving. Okay, so that's the announcement for last week. And hope to hear you, hope you will hear me this coming Saturday, 1 p.m. and Saturdays subsequently, 1 p.m. Eastern Time, Alternative Visions, Progressive Radio Network. We're going to go after this global picture. Okay. Now, let's turn back to a global topic, not unrelated, and that is the Trans-Pacific Partnership, TPP, free trade, 12 countries in the Pacific Rim trying to come together, U.S. leading the charge, to establish a free trade zone. And in the right behind that, the U.S. trying to, and Europe trying to create the same thing in Europe. It's a little slower. By the way, that's what French President Hollande was coming over here to talk about. French economy being deep doo-doo, attempting to get investment from the U.N. The so-called socialist president, François Hollande, what's he doing? Supply-sider. He's turning into a Reagan supply-sider. You know, don't trust those social democrats like Hollande and so forth. They call themselves socialist, but they're not anything near socialist. Okay, so that's what that's about. They're trying to do the same thing over there. And, of course, Obama's been driving it over here as a follow-up to under his regime, having approved the free trade agreements with single countries like Colombia and so forth. Okay, so this is the big one. But they're having trouble. They're having trouble doing it. Well, to what extent is this trouble with closing this deal on TPP, the trouble, to what extent is it really temporary, we might say? You know, after all, it's an election year, and they always, politicians in Washington always go light in election years on putting screws to people. Right? I mean, like, we're not going to have any deficit cutting this year because it's an election year, just like we did in 2012. But we had it in 2011. We had it in 13. Well, we're going to have to wait for 2015 for the politicians to put the screws to us again. I mean, there are several screws already in our coffin, but they'll put more, but not this year. And, of course, we've got a holdup here on pushing TPP as well. Senate Majority Leader Senator Reid has said, nope, not before the election, folks. Okay, so things are sort of stalling a little bit politically. Oh, they'll heat up after the election, I'm sure. But in the meantime, there are problems brewing between the negotiators. Latest is the U.S. and Japan can't come to an agreement on TPP. Well, that may be because they know there's an election here and they don't need to come to an agreement right now. Well, we'll see. Anyway, we got a guest tonight who is an expert on this. He's been on the show before about a year ago talking about TPP, Art Stamoulis. Art, you there? Hello, Art. Well, my goodness, Art didn't show up. Okay. Well, I guess we're just going to have to talk our way on this thing. Okay, so yours truly is going to have to BS about this a little bit more. TPP, what are free trade agreements? Okay, you think they're about goods and services? No, they're not really about goods and services. What are they about, then? Well, I wouldn't say they're not about goods and services. Yes, to some extent, they are about goods and services. Exchange of goods and services, you might say. Okay? Well, exchange, that means exports and imports of goods and services. Yeah, that's apparently what trade is about. You know, the North American Free Trade Agreement, NAFTA, right? U.S., Canada, and others exchanging goods and services. But you know what it's really about, what free trade agreements are really about, are about foreign direct investment. Well, what's foreign direct investment? Oh, that's where investors, bankers, shadow bankers, very high net worth individuals and the like, do what? Oh, well, they take their money and they invest in these other countries. That's foreign direct investment. Corporations, too, you know, big multinational corporations, they build their auto plant in Shanghai rather than in Detroit and get cheap wages and get access, direct access to massive markets in these emerging economies, and a whole bunch of other bennies as a result. So free trade agreements are really, when you think about it, more about foreign direct investment, or as they say, FDI. The terms and conditions on which a country and its corporations get favorable treatment and access to invest in those other countries. Now, what do we mean by invest? Well, investment, you can build your own factory in the country. Investment means you can give some money to a company that's already there, a partner, right, and jointly expand production or expand marketing or whatever you decide on. In other words, joint production, joint marketing, and bring some money over to get that going, right? Or you can buy up a company or buy into a company. In other words, you're not going to expand anything. You're just going to take a position in that company. Now, some countries say, like China, well, you can't have more than 50% or 49%. And other countries say, oh, come in, buy up the whole thing, right? It varies from country to country, but FDI means moving in, buying up the country, the company, and or jointly, joint production, and or starting something up yourself from scratch. Build your own factory there. You know, a lot of host countries like that idea because, you know, it expands hiring, it expands output, they get taxes and so forth. So they like that idea. In other words, add to production. Don't just buy your way in. But, you know, FDI takes both forms. Now, FDI also takes the form of financial investment, pure financial investment. In other words, investors go and buy up the stocks or buy bonds, corporate bonds, from companies that are already there. Financial investment is different from real asset, physical investment. And, you know, in the last 5 years, a lot of the FDI into these countries has been financial investment, financial speculation. After all, the Federal Reserve pumped $14 trillion at least into the U.S., and that means global economy. And where did a lot of it go? Well, a lot of it went into financial speculation, not just in the U.S., but offshore. In other words, FDI money flows. FDI, foreign direct investment, can be money flow or it can be goods flow, investing in goods or just investing in securities. A lot of it, and we don't know, there's no way to determine exactly how much, but a lot of it is financial speculation, investing in financial securities, in other words. And some of it has been investing in real assets, real production, in the emerging markets, not in the U.S. You know, there are all these multinational corporations and investors are investing offshore in what we're called emerging markets. And that's where a lot of the Fed, U.S. Federal Reserve, Central Bank money injection went over the last 5 years. Didn't go to stimulate the U.S. economy. It went to stimulate offshore economies, you know, particularly countries and economies like, you know, Brazil, in South Africa, Indonesia, places like that, right? But that's the nature of monetary policy today. In a global market where money is global, it moves around instantaneously and so forth. There are no... This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. Somehow I got cut off or a line dropped, so I'm going to try to pick up where I think we left off, but we'll continue on this topic of the TPP here. I may repeat myself a little bit here because I'm not sure where we got dropped off. Okay, and our guest did not show up, so I'm talking about the TPP myself. And the point is, you have to think of the Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade on steroids in a broader context. That context is the growing crisis in the global economy. You know, sometimes crisis doesn't appear to be a crisis. It's developing under the covers, you might say. Things can be getting worse while they look like they're getting better. And that's the question here with regard to the global economy. Long-term trend, the global economy is slowing. Long-term periods up, you know, a little bit, and then a retreat again. And some countries, you know, recovering better than others while others are getting worse. But if you look at the whole picture, and you've got to look at the whole global economy here, you cannot look anymore at just U.S. or North America or Europe and so forth, because it's global capitalism and it's a global crisis, which, as I said, is just morphing and changing its appearance and its location. Okay, and that brings us to the whole question of free trade. You know, if global economies are slowing and global trade is on a long-term downturn, then what you get is countries trying to get an advantage against each other by negotiating free trade agreements. Okay, during the 1930s, what happened was countries tried to get an advantage and boost their own domestic economies, which were in depression, by lowering the value of their currencies by what's called, you know, fiat devaluation. In other words, just declaring where our currency is no longer going to trade against gold at the prevailing rate, we're going to reduce the value of our currency. Well, when you reduce the value of your currency, you make your exports more competitive. And what you're doing essentially is taking production from another country because you're selling more exports to them than their domestic industry might be able to produce. So you're boosting your domestic economy that produces for exports at the expense of another country's economy that now cannot compete in those same exports. So devaluation, currency devaluation, is a tactic, a business tactic, an economic tactic to boost your own economy at the expense of somebody else. Okay, so that's how they did it, and it extended and deepened the depression in the 1930s. And trade between countries just about collapsed, all right? And economies that are very dependent on trade, like if you look at the individual countries in Europe, very dependent on exports, particularly Germany and others as well. You know, the tendency is to try to get an advantage, a cost advantage for your goods at the exports of your competitors. Okay, so now we're not on a gold standard anymore. We haven't been since 1973, and that means devaluations of currencies can take other forms. In other words, the whole idea is to get your cost of your exports lower than your competitors. Well, the favorite tactic today in fluctuating mutual exchange rates is to reduce your costs by attacking wages. And that's what's happening in Europe. You know, wherever you hear this talk about, labor market reform, that phrase is a code phrase for, let's see how we can reduce wages and benefits. And that's what's happening. You know, you get getting a little recovery in exports in countries like Spain and so forth. Why? Because they've driven their wage cost way down, and benefit cost way down. So they can produce their goods a little more efficiently than somebody else. Same thing has occurred in Ireland. Same thing in other periphery economies in Europe. You know, labor market reform, which means mimic what the U.S. has already done for the last 10, 12 years. You see, this lack of wage growth in the U.S. is purposeful. It's not by accident. And that's why U.S. exports have gotten a little bit of an advantage, cost advantage, over others. Okay, so now we turn to China. China is very also dependent on export trade. And its wages have been kept quite low for some time, but wages are rising there now. So China is not as competitive as it was in terms of export. So the other thing China is doing is driving down the value of its exchange rate, its currency, as a way of lowering its costs. So what we've got today is something similar to what we had in the 1930s, where what we're doing, well, what these countries are doing is trade competition, quid pro quo. You know, I'm going to lower my costs one way, exchange rate and or wage compression, et cetera. And another country does the same thing. And, you know, they're going back and forth. But in the meantime, it's a race to the bottom for workers and their incomes. And we see that everywhere. One of the favorite ways, by the way, of reducing wages is to shift to what's called contingent labor. What's that? That's part-time temporary workers, part-time temporary workers. You know, about 30% maybe of the U.S. workforce, some say, are now part-time temp. You know, part-time temp workers, you know, get one-half to two-thirds the pay for the same work per hour, and they get no benefits. So companies are saving, you know, probably somewhere between 25 and 40% on their total labor cost by shifting people to part-time temp work. All right, so it's not just the U.S. It's the same situation in Europe. More and more people part-time temp work. And in Japan as well. 40% of the workforce in Japan is part-time temp right now. So you see this big surge in second-class citizenship when it comes to work. More and more people, you know, are on the edge with part-time temp work. And that's just, you know, it's, we're not talking about services and restaurants, just about all restaurant and all about, you know, entertainment. Well, entertainment meaning, you know, hotels and lodgings and so forth, and retail are part-time temp people, except for maybe the managers. And even in education, reports recently show that in colleges in the U.S., something above two-thirds of all the college instructors now are not tenured professors. They're part-time adjuncts or lecturers and so forth. 70%. Well, colleges and universities are really reducing their costs, aren't they? Well, how the hell then can all these price increases in education, in college education, continue? You know, it's now the fastest price escalation of any service in any industry in the U.S., higher education, even more than healthcare right now. Just keeps going up and up. Well, how the hell are these colleges and universities raising their prices, while they're cutting their cost on labor? I mean, they're getting the best of two deals, aren't they? Well, yes, they're getting the best of two deals because the government and private sector is providing more and more debt to students to pay for the rising costs. More and more debt. That's why over $1 trillion of debt for students today, and it's still continuing to rise. In other words, it's government money that's going from the taxpayer right to the university administrators, and they're so flush with all this money that they, you know, they can build these university resorts, you know, the big rush here, competition between universities. You know, how many great facilities can we provide? You know, how many Olympic swimming pools, and how, you know, how many great student unions and all this facilities? You know, pretty soon we'll have golf courses on these colleges. So they got the best of both worlds, and the money's flowing in. Meanwhile, the students become indentured, leaving college with tens of thousands of dollars or more of debt. And by the way, what you read in the paper is underestimation of the amount of student debt. You know, that's only government loans. Anyway, to get back to the main point, wage compression and part-time contingent work is an example of many examples of wage compression, is the new tactic here when it comes to competition. Globally, and trade competition. Okay, so that brings us back one step further to the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And what is this all about? Well, this is, as I said, not primarily about reducing tariffs on exports and imports. Yes, that's in there. But it's mostly about terms and conditions for multinational corporations to get a deeper foothold in another country's economy, and therefore move more jobs offshore and move more foreign direct investment from the U.S. To those locations because it's more profitable. But when you got 12 countries trying to come to an agreement like the TPP, you know, it's not so easy to get these trade deals done. It's easier, relatively, when it's country to country, or what we call bilateral free trade. But it's not so easy when you've got 12 countries, because they all have their vested political economic interest. Recent information in the business press is about how the U.S. and Japan all of a sudden can't come to a deal. Now, U.S. and Japan are two of the countries involved in the Trans-Pacific Partnership negotiations. What does it mean they can't come to a deal here, an agreement? Well, negotiations have sort of broken down between Japan and the U.S. on this whole question of their respective roles in the TPP. Well, what are the issues behind that? And what's going to come next? Well, the issues behind that are Japan wants a better advantage of importing into the U.S. You know, Japanese cars sell pretty good in the U.S. They want an even more favorable conditions in which to import cars to the U.S. And then Japan is very sensitive about its agricultural goods industries. In other words, its production of dairy and sugar and rice and so forth, which means it's small farmers. And they don't want to face up to massive agribusiness competition from U.S. agricultural interests. Well, you know, the Archer Daniel Midlands and so forth, Cargills, they really want to get into Japan. And food processors in the U.S., big time, they want to get into Japan. So the difficulty is getting an agreement on agricultural FDI and agricultural exports and cars, FDI and exports. Market access, in other words, is what it's about, which means investment, foreign investment, not just goods and services exchanged. It's about money flow exchange. That's even more important than goods and services, right? And that's where the negotiations now have been breaking down between Japan and the U.S. But it's temporary, believe me. It's not long-term, and it's not going to mean the end of TPP. TPP has not been defeated. TPP is simply on hold for political reasons and temporarily. On hold in the U.S. because it's an election year. You know, when Senator Reid, and Democratic Majority Leader in the Senate, Harry Reid, announced that he wasn't going to give fast-track negotiating authority to the Obama administration. He wasn't going to agree to that. What he was really saying was, look, you know, free trade means we're going to screw a lot of workers. We know that. We've done it before with NAFTA and so forth. This is an election year. We got to be a little careful about this. Let's wait till the election's over. You watch. TPP will move sideways during the rest of this year until after the November midterm elections, then it will go on a fast track again. You watch. Definitely. In the meantime, other countries negotiating with the U.S. on TPP meetings, they kind of know what's happening politically in the U.S., that the U.S. can't move on this. Right, Harry Reid signaled, and Obama administration puts it on the, you know, the back burner for a few more months. They know this, so why should they agree to anything right now? Why should they make concessions now when the U.S. can't really negotiate and make concessions till after November? So that's why TPP and Japan, U.S. at the center of it even, is sort of going to be on hold for a while. But, you know, they'll work out the differences behind the scenes here, so that when the November elections are over, they'll be able to move quickly. Obama, in fact, is going to Japan in April. And he will discuss with Abe, Prime Minister Abe, these terms, and they'll agree to the major outlines of an agreement, and then they'll let their trade reps sort of meet quietly over the next few months and work out the deals behind closed doors quietly, and then we'll see the whole thing emerge again right after the November elections. By the way, since we're on the question of Japan, we'll come back to that more in some future lectures here and future discussions. We'll come back to that. But something interesting is going on in Japan, if you haven't noticed. First of all, its so-called new economic program that was launched about a year ago is running out of steam. Yes. That's where Japan mimicked the U.S. Federal Reserve Bank of Japan and pumped, you know, even more currency liquidity money into its financial markets per its size of GDP than the U.S. did under the Federal Reserve. And, of course, just like the Federal Reserve, that resulted in a big boom in stock and bond and financial markets for the Japanese investors. And now that's sort of slowing down. At first, when this started, Japan GDP grew 4% first half of 2013. But it dissipated pretty quickly, as all these money injections do. And last quarter of last year, the latest data that we have, Japan's only grown about 1% or less. Well, that's very typical of just a money injection kind of recovery policy that benefits bankers and investors with very little trickles down to the rest of the economy. And that's what's happened in Japan. You got to keep in mind, too, that in Japan, for 20 years now, there's been essentially no real wage increases for anybody. And now real wages, with inflation going back up, are beginning to fall even faster than they did before. You know, Japan's real wages dropped by 1.5% in the past year. That's big for 1 year. Okay, so people just don't have the money to buy real goods and services, and now Japan's going to raise sales taxes from 5% to 8% here in the next couple months. Well, that's going to whack the recovery in Japan even more. Abe, or what's called Abenomics, has come to a standstill. It's hit a wall. And you watch. They're going to do the same thing we did in the U.S. when we hit a wall in 2010. Oh, we need more QE. We need more central bank money injection. And that will boost the stock market up again. By the way, you know, with this first money injection round last year, the stock market went up 80%. But now it's down 6% in just a few months. Well, when that happened in the U.S., the Fed came out with QE2. And that boosted the stock markets and bond markets again. And when that started to dissipate, run its course, we had QE3, which we're still dealing with. So typical injections of trillions of dollars of free money into bankers and investors has been the capitalist answer to the crisis. And it's done wonders for bankers and wealthy investors and stock markets and so forth. But it's done nothing, essentially, for the rest of the economy. Well, Japan's just following the same track the U.S. a couple of years behind. But we'll talk more about Japan in future radio shows here. By the way, it's a good time for me to announce once again, Alternative Visions is moving its date and time. We are moving to Saturday, starting this Saturday, March 1st, 1 p.m. Eastern Time. And as I said at the beginning of this particular show today, I'll be talking more about China. We're going deeper into the problems in the Chinese economy. Is it really slowing down? If so, why? And what are the consequences? Is there really a growing problem with financial instability in its local debt markets and housing markets? And if so, what's the consequences? Not just for China, but for the rest of the global economy. China's the largest economy, second largest economy in the world now, behind the U.S., $10 trillion. Oh, if it sneezes, somebody in the rest of the world is going to catch cold. That's probably emerging markets in Europe. Anyway, That's the situation we'll be talking about this Saturday on the show, Saturday, 1 p.m., where we're moving to. And after that, we'll be talking also about other sectors in the global economy, emerging markets, you know, Brazil, Indonesia, South Africa, so forth. We'll also be talking more about Japan. There are four major segments or sections in the global economy. Well, maybe five. We got U.S., clearly. We got China, clearly. Europe, clearly. Japan. And then we have the emerging markets, you know, the Brazils and Indonesia's, Turkey's, and so forth. What is the interactions between these five sectors of the global economy as the crisis shifts from one then to the other? What's the impact? What can we expect? All right, we'll be talking more about that in future radio shows here, starting this Saturday with China. Let's come back to Japan. We've been talking about the TPP agreement and pretty much coming to a standstill here because the U.S. and Japanese recently just could not come to an agreement on market access, FDI, investments, etc. And we talked that you know, a lot of this has this lack of agreement between Japan and the U.S. and between the U.S. and the rest of the 12 TPP countries negotiating it has to do with the signal that the U.S. does not really want to proceed rapidly on this until after the November election. Okay. Something else in Japan. I'm sure you've been reading about or listening to all this fight between Japan and China over the Senkaku Islands, or Diu Islands, as the Chinese call them, if I pronounce that right. What are they fighting over? A few rocks in the middle of the Western Pacific. Well, you know, there's oil under them dollar hills, you might say, and both those countries are short of oil. You know, Japan has has no oil. Japan has to import all of its oil, and that's why it's relied so heavily on nuclear energy and nuclear power plants. And we all know about Fukushima, don't we? Yeah, well, Japan's just announced they're going to start rebuilding more nuclear plants, believe it or not. Yes, they're going to poison that entire country, 100 million people. You know, already a good segment of it is poisoned. And they're actually moving people back into the poisoned areas. Can you believe that? At a time when they're even having more leaks and more polluted, nuclear-polluted waters leaking into the ocean and into the air. They're moving people back into that region. And they're going to start building more nuclear plants. Boggles the mind, doesn't it? Yes, well, when it comes to making money, who cares about people getting poisoned? That's the least of the concern of those who are going to get rich. There's another thing happening in Japan people got to make a mental note of here, and it's related to the Senkaku island dispute, and to nuclear. And that is the new Prime Minister, Abe, well, he's not so new, he's been there a year or so, right, is taking on this nationalist, to put it nicely, nationalist tone to his whole regime. You know, he's rattling the swords over those islands and talking more and more about building up Japan's defense industries, in other words, more independent development of arms instead of being dependent upon the U.S., which it has been since 1945 for its defense and its arms, really boosting the Japan Defense Force, in other words, making it more a true military force, which it increasingly has become. And, you know, this guy Abe, he goes to this the shrine of the war dead in Japan periodically, and you know, he sort of gives honor to some of the excesses of Japanese aggression. You know, we talk about the Holocaust in Europe under the Nazis, but we don't talk enough about it. We don't know enough here in the West about the Holocaust that Japanese militarists imposed on China. I mean, they probably killed more people in China than Hitler did Jews in Europe. I don't know the exact numbers, but it truly was millions. All we hear about is the rape of Nanking battle during World War II, where Japan took over the Chinese city, Nanking, and just murdered hundreds of thousands of people. I mean, literally lined them up and shot them. Okay, war crimes, right? Yes. And the Chinese are very rightfully sensitive about Japanese militarism. Okay, I'm getting to a point here, and that is this. That is this. There's been a little blurb in the press, not picked up and emphasized very much, but that blurb says this. The United States, the U.S., listen to this. The U.S. has asked Japan to return hundreds of kilos of plutonium that the U.S. had given them years ago to use to develop their domestic nuclear power plant industry. Now, plutonium is weapons grade. And the amount of plutonium that the U.S. gave Japan, that Japan has, is equivalent, would allow Japan to make 40 to 50 nuclear weapons. 40 to 50 nuclear weapons. Now, why is the U.S. asking Japan for that plutonium back? Do they know something going on that we don't? Yeah, I think so. I think they kind of know what Japan's plans might be. And the U.S. is worried. The U.S. does not want a nuclear confrontation in the short run in Asia. I mean, look, U.S. businesses are making too much money in China. They don't want that kind of confrontation there. Yes, both sides can build up their conventional forces, and that's what the pivot to Asia is all about by Obama, right? We're going to move money out of the Army and the fight in the Middle East, and we're going to give it to the Navy and Air Force to build up the Western Pacific. They're moving the money around. You know, you may have read something about in the last day or two about the Secretary of Defense talking about, oh, we're going to have to cut the budget, you know, the Army budget. Well, yeah, they're going to downgrade troops. Yeah. So they can continue their contracts with the defense contractors. That's the most important relationship, you know, not whether U.S. vets get decent health care, right? Or retirement. They don't care about that. What they care about is these defense contracts with GE and so forth, right? So they're moving the money around. They're shifting the money around out of the Middle East, some of it. Doesn't mean they're going to leave. They're moving it to the Western Pacific and more contracts, build more ships with General Electric, you know, build more aircraft with Lockheed and so forth. This high technology stuff that's needed in the Western Pacific to confront China. And China's building, you know, its military and trying to push out its borders, just as every other country, you know, 200 miles official borders. You know, China is stuck with effectively a much smaller border. We're talking about borders, ocean, offshore. Anyway, I think it's pretty interesting about this plutonium request and what's going on in Japan at the moment. And this increased shift towards militarism by Abe, the prime minister over there. Keep a watch on that, right? Keep a watch. And, of course, that strengthens Japan's negotiations with the U.S. on other issues, like the TPP. If the U.S. wants that back, they're going to have to pay for it. You know, well, I think what the Japanese will do will go very slow on returning of that, any of that plutonium, and will never return it all. Okay, so that's the picture there. When we talk about TPP and we talk about China and Asia and Japan economically, now I want to say a few words as well on the situation in the Ukraine. Ukraine, right? You know what happened here a few days ago. In the Ukraine, we had a coup d'etat, didn't we? And I say we because you know, the U.S. was directly involved in all that. Reports are that they've spent like $5 billion on this Ukrainian opposition and fomenting this, quote, they call it a revolution. I guess it is a kind of a revolution of sorts, more like a coup d'etat. But revolution in the sense of totally different people getting control of the Ukraine now, at least the Western Ukraine. You know, you saw all these pictures of everybody assaulting the city hall there, whatever those government buildings were on the Maidan Square, right? And it looks like freedom fighters, you know, fighting for their independence and so forth. But, you know, look behind the appearances, right? And what do you see? Well, on the Yanukovych, in other words, he was the president who's running around the country trying to hide now. You know, who is he? Who is this guy, Yanukovych? Well, he's part of the leftover of the bureaucrats. And with the Soviet collapse, Soviet Union collapse decades, a couple decades ago, you know, all these big communist leaders of industry and so forth jumped ship and became capitalists. You know, that's why the system basically collapsed. One of the reasons they gave up on their own system because they saw there was a lot of money to be made, and they became capitalists themselves, right? And the capitalism over there is what's called crony capitalism. All the old bureaucrats are scratching each other's back, giving each other all kinds of contracts and so forth, and getting filthy rich. Well, that's his background. That's Yanukovych's background. You know, he's got certain capitalists, cronies, who were, you know, in the parliament, all corrupt as hell, and making each other rich. You know, that's going on in the old Soviet Empire everywhere, just about, you know, and making each other very rich in the process and corrupt. And so you get another group that doesn't want to be of that group of capitalists of sorts. They want to be aligned with the capitalists in the West, right? And what's happening over there is the economy is in a real mess and has been for a number of years. Of all of the, quote, emerging markets, Ukraine is probably the worst. Now, Ukraine has a huge debt, external debt, that I don't see how it can be paid. And their foreign reserves, the currency, are collapsing. Money is now flowing out of Ukraine even faster than before. So these capitalists wanted to ally with, you know, the new ones, with Europe, and get some money coming in from Europe to save their ass. So you got the old crony capitalists versus against the new capitalist, Western Europe capitalist, fighting it out. Now, on the street, you don't see these guys. You know, what do you see on the street fighting it out? Well, you see, you know, people were throwing Molotov cocktails and bats and fighting cops and shooting each other and so forth. Well, who are these people on the street? Well, it's a pretty mixed crew, but amongst them in a leading role are the new fascists over there. Svoboda Party, how do you pronounce it? I don't know. Svoboda Party and a couple other parties, the UPA and so forth. Who are these guys? These are clearly proto-fascist groups who have a totally different agenda than the two capitalist groups fighting it out amongst themselves. Now, the Svoboda Party was previously called, and listen to this, the National Socialist Party of the Ukraine. Well, gee, that sounds like a Nazi party. The National Socialist Party of the Ukraine? Yeah, that was the Svoboda Party before it changed its name. And now, of course, a name doesn't mean that much, but if you look at the tactics and listen to their leaders, which they sometimes get some airtime, very clearly. They're even, you know, a number of them make statements that are even grossly anti-Semitic. You know, so their whole ideology, a lot of it they're keeping under wraps here, is really a kind of fascist ideology. Now, these people rule the streets. The capitalists are in the parliament, right? And the fight had been going on for 3 months until all of a sudden the parliament abandons Yanukovych. Well, why did these guys, these capitalists who were in the parliament, abandon Yanukovych at the last minute? Well, very simply, the EU and the West threatened to freeze all their money and their assets in the West. And all these guys, being crooked as hell, send their money to Europe, to the West. Well, you know, there's nothing like freezing the personal financial assets in the West of these corrupt capitalist politicians in the parliament in Ukraine to get them to change sides overnight. That's exactly what happened. And Yanukovych thought he had these guys behind him, and they overnight abandoned him. Well, then he had to do, what could he do but run? Run, Yanukovych, run! You know? And their loyalties are elsewhere. But the street is still ruled by these fascist parties, or dominated. Not everybody on the street is fascist, don't get me wrong. Right. Now, these fascist parties will not settle for another deal in which they are cut out. They feel they made this revolution, this coup, and yes, and to some extent, they did on the street. And they want a piece of the action. They want a foothold in the new parliament. Now, the U.S. that sort of went over there and pushed the whole thing, you know, what's her name, Virginia Nuland, you know, the Assistant Secretary of State, who got caught saying, fuck the EU, because the EU wasn't being aggressive enough. The U.S. was going to take over and really stimulate this thing, right? Really back these forces on the ground, which it did. Well, by the way, Virginia Nuland, did you know that she was a personal advisor to Dick Cheney for a number of years here during the George Bush regime? Nuland is a neocon that's still there. Still there, stirring the pots, you know? Anyway, financially, the Ukraine is broke. Well, they say they need $35 billion to stabilize the economy there. They need more than $50 billion. Where are they going to get it? Europeans going to get it to give it to them? Europe that doesn't even want to spend it on Greece and its own easy European Eurozone countries? They're going to... I mean, they dribble it out to Greece. They're going to give them $35, $50 billion? No way. They're going to say they're going to do it. And the U.S. is going to say they're going to throw money in the pot because they want to influence the elections coming up this spring and make sure friendly, stable people, now that they got what they want, friendly, stable parliament comes out of this that doesn't have the radicals, the right-wing radicals in it. Ah, that's what's really behind this, the elections coming up. Oh, we're going to put money in, stable, I vote for our people. You know, they're going to go out and they're going to say, we're going to do this, we're going to get all this Western money finally, etc. It's not going to be delivered. Okay? And the right wing on the ground is not going to be satisfied if it is kept out of the game. And you're going to see more disruption, more instability in the Ukraine. It may stabilize and look like it is for a short period of time, but it will only be a short period of time because the radicals now have the wind behind them, and they're not going to settle for being kept out. And the maneuvers by the EU and the U.S. Are not going to succeed in doing that. And we're going to have another period of relative calm that will explode eventually if they are kept out. If they are allowed in, it's even worse. If they are allowed in, then you're going to see the eastern part and the Crimea, which were really Russia before Russia ceded them to the Ukraine. You know, all these eastern provinces were Russian, were ceded to the Ukraine after World War II, and the Crimea ceded to the Ukraine in the 1950s. To sort of balance the composition of attitudes in the Ukraine. The Western Ukraine has always been anti-Russia, even under the Soviet system, anti-Russian. And these new provinces were added to offset that anti-Russia sentiment in the Western Ukraine. And you're going to see Crimea certainly secede, maybe the eastern provinces, if the fascist radicals get a foothold, and we're going to see whether they do or not in the next election, and whether these maneuvers by the EU and U.S. really succeed in getting who they want. A new crowd of crony capitalists, but crony now, not to the old Soviet bureaucracy, but crony to Western Europe and U.S. capitalist interests. Okay, one final announcement. Next Saturday, coming Saturday, March 1st, 1 p.m., we're going to be moving Alternative Visions to that new time and date, and we're going to be talking deeper about what's going on in China. Is it going to slow further? Is there going to be a layman moment in its financial instability? This is Jack Rasmus, Alternative Visions. Talk to you on Saturday.